Hello and welcome to Summer School at the Modern. So we have already been introduced to abstract expressionism and pop art. Today, Dr. Catherine Caesar will introduce us to minimalism. And the program wraps up next month on the 11th with a look at conceptual art with Dr. Michael Corris. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kathy Caesar. She is an assistant professor of art at the University of Dallas. She earned her MA in art history from Tulane University and her PhD in art history from Emory in 2005. Recent awards include the King Hager Faculty Development Award for Research in New York, which she was awarded in February of this year. And she was curator, organizer, program coordinator, and writer for the Video Art, The Early Years exhibition at Haggerty Gallery in 2008. She's been published in important journals such as Art Lies and Art Forum, and she's given numerous presentations and papers over the last 10 years. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Catherine Caesar. Okay, so we're here to talk about minimalism. I told Leslie I was actually happy that you don't publish it on the website, the topic, because I was afraid that maybe people would think, oh, minimalism, I'm not going to come. But of course, I love minimalism. I've talked to some of you that are big fans of minimalism, too, so hopefully we can have a lively discussion about it today. I'm starting out standing in front of not the earliest piece that I'm going to talk about, but one of the pieces that represents kind of the earliest phase of minimalism. This is a piece by Carl Andre. It's dated 1971. It's called Tau and Threshold, and it's made of red cedar. And although it's dated 71, it really represents a stage circa 1965. The very early days of minimalism, and it's something that he would just come and revisit a couple of years later. So we're going to talk about this piece in a minute and talk about a lot of the other objects in this room, but let me just sort of talk about minimalism in general. Minimal art, like many art movements, is not a self-titled movement from the artists. They did not walk around calling themselves minimalists necessarily, but rather it's the name that we art historians like to attach to certain people so that we can sort of cohere them together. Other names for minimalism at the time included primary art, primary structures, ABC art, pure art, boring art, depending on the view of the critic. But as you can see, just by looking behind me and around you, that some of the main characteristics that represent minimalism are geometric structures, right? There's a very strong basis in geometry. A lot of the work is three-dimensional also. We're going to be talking about painting today. We're going to be talking about Agnes Martin. We're going to be talking about Bryce Marden. But a lot of the work tends to have a strong physical presence. And again, we will talk about why. The most important and arguably, but in my opinion, the most important minimalist show that kind of started this whole phenomenon occurred in 1966. And that show was called Primary Structures, and it was at the Jewish Museum in New York. And it united early works by many of the people that we're going to be talking about today. Carl Andre, Donald Judd, Dan Flavin, and Robert Morris, Robert Smithson, sort of all of the biggies that you can think of were united in this exhibition. And it was really the public's first opportunity to see this new type of art, which, again, it tends to be primarily three-dimensional, tends to be based in geometry, and for many of the artists that we're going to be talking about, one of the most important aspects of the work was that it was literal. That it did not refer to anything outside of itself and its materials. And this is a very important distinction for minimalism. If you've been to some of the other summer school talks, if you know the pieces that are in the galleries that precede this, you know that some of the strongest movements
in the United States prior to minimalism were expressionist. Of course, the most well-known one being abstract expressionism. Okay, abstract expressionism, late 40s, throughout the 1950s, was the dominant U.S. art form. Many would argue that it was actually the first truly American art form, abstract expressionism. You know the work of Jackson Pollock, you know the work of de Kooning, you know the beautiful images you have from Clifford Still and Adolf Gottlieb in this collection. All of these really important works. Well, why is that important for something that looks like this, right? Why would Jackson Pollock drip paintings somehow relate to three pieces of red cedar stacked on top of one another? Well, one of the reasons why is that minimalism in many ways was construed as an opposition to the ideals of abstract expressionism. Even by 1965, 1966, when these artists are beginning to think about this conception of minimalism, abstract expressionism was still the dominant form in New York. We have second-generation abstract expressionist painters. There's been a whole phenomenon called the Tenth Street Touch that mimicked, say, de Kooning's gestural style. So a lot of the artists, the young artists that come around during this era say, enough. Enough expressionism. We don't need to have an artwork be telling about the artist's soul, about the artist's psyche, about what happened to him or her when they were children, about surrealism, about psychoanalysis. Artwork need not tell anything about the producer whatsoever. Art can just be appreciated for the material qualities and also the way that we have a physical or experiential relationship with the object. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. This piece, Carl Andre's work, and we're going to go see one of his floor pieces in a minute that you probably know very well in the next room. This piece represents, again, one of his earliest conceptions of sculpture. He called it the Elements series. And I think you can tell why it's called the Elements series. It's very elemental, right? It's geometric. It looks like an eye. It consists, again, of these three pieces of uncarved wood that are not adhered to one another. He's not using mortar. He's not using nails. So it's one material. And what Carl Andre was very insistent on, the notion of matter. Matter was important to him. Material was important to him. And so he wanted, and he was sort of thinking about the Russian constructivists of the 1920s, too, to whom from whom he was very influenced. But he wanted to be true to what wood would do. What does wood do well? It stacks well. Okay, so he doesn't need to carve it, he doesn't need to change it, he finds his materials, he pays homage to the material itself, he keeps it simple, he keeps it literal. Again, it does not refer to anything beyond what it is, which is wood. Also, at the time, he was sharing a studio with a man who many consider to be the first minimalist painter, and that was Frank Stella. He shared a studio with him really in the late 50s, but in his thinking about these pieces, he was working closely with Frank Stella. So some would say that the linear quality of the three planks is related to Frank Stella's stripe paintings of the late 50s and the early 60s. Probably more important for our purposes is one of Frank Stella's most famous dictums, one of his most famous idioms in his work was, what you see is what you see. Okay, don't look beyond this. Don't analyze. Don't translate. Don't look for Carl Andre in this. What you see is what you see. So if that's the case, if we can't interpret this in any sort of traditional art historical way, then what do we do with it? Why is it important? Why are we bothering to talk about it? What was Carl Andre seeking? Well, I already mentioned this idea of truth to materials. I already mentioned this idea of his fascination with matter, and we'll talk about that more when we get to his metal pieces. But I guess something, and Carl Andre didn't really specifically talk about this, but I think this is an aspect of minimalism that can be that is shared by a lot of the artists that we're going to be talking about that. And that is what I mentioned earlier about this experiential relationship to the object. Here I've been standing next to this piece the whole time since we've been here, and one of the things that you probably notice is that we're about the same size. Okay, now I realize that I'm not the same size as a lot of people, right? I wore heels specifically on purpose, so I'd be a little bit closer to it. But one of the things about a lot of the objects that you'll see, you can think about the Sarah, you can think about the Jackie Windsor, for example, one of the things, even Agnes Martin's canvases, which are about 6 feet tall, one of the things you'll notice is that it's human scale. And so when we talk about this piece, what do? We compare our bodies to the object. Because we can't think about anything else, right? We can't think about imagery. We can't think about analysis. So what we just wind up walking around it. And something that was important for the minimalists in general was this experiential relationship to an object. Okay, so I recognize that this thing has a physical presence, it's three-dimensional, and what do I think of? I think of me. I think of my body. I think of my existence in the world. We are both, in essence, social entities in that we exist in this space, exist in this society. And that, for many of the minimalists, was powerful enough. Just that focus on human perception, human scale. One other thing about this piece before we move on, we'll go talk about the Donald Judd next. But another thing that's important about this piece, of course, unlike a lot of sculpture, is that there's no pedestal. And look around you. Do you see any pedestals in this room? Isn't sculpture supposed to have a pedestal? You know, isn't it supposed to be raised up and commemorative and celebrate something lofty and elevated, right? That the pedestal marks something. You know, if there's a pedestal, it's an art object, right? It is to be revered. Well, obviously, Andre, you know, you can tell by some of the rationale that I've been talking about thus far. Obviously, he's going to oppose that type of thing. Why would you elevate something that's stacked wood and doesn't attempt to transcend that? So it was very important to him that the object not have a pedestal and that it have contact with the floor. Okay, we're going to talk about gravity when we get to Carl Andre's metal pieces. But that weight, gravity of the object is realized when it's placed right on the floor. He was also very influenced by the Romanian sculptor Constantin Brancusi. Dan Flavin actually dedicated his first neon piece, fluorescent light piece, which is very like this one, to Constantin Brancusi. So he was very influential for these artists. Well, Brancusi, you probably know his Bird in Flight, his Endless Column, works like that. For Brancusi, the pedestal was as essential as the object, and indeed, it was part of the artwork. And, of course, Endless Column, which is these carved geometric shapes that seem to descend into infinity, is placed on the ground, literally on the ground. So that was something that was very important for Carl Andre. Can we move into the stacked piece to talk about Donald Judd next? Sure, I keep thinking I'm going to refer to them, and I probably will never look at them.
Thank you.
For many of the minimalists were prolific writers. Carl Andre was, he wrote about his work, but he was also a poet. As a matter of fact, recently a book of his poetry was just published under the name Cuts. But Donald Judd was not only an artist, but one of the most important art critics of his generation. He was the voice of Arts Magazine, which was a very important art journal during the 1960s in particular. He reviewed other people's work, he talked about his own, and anytime we talk about one of Donald Judd's objects, it's very difficult to talk about it without referencing his key writing from 1965, which was called Specific Objects, where he talked about the artists that he loved, but also talked about his general conception of art making. That is extremely reductive in approach. And when he uses the term specific objects, what he mainly means by specific is that it is one thing. Specific or discrete, one thing. Art, in his opinion, should be one thing. Not two, one. Well, this is not one thing. It's steel and plexiglass. And there's 10 units. Okay, so that's weird, right? So we need, I think, to address briefly why he wants art to be one thing. And also how he could justify these, or generally known as the stacked pieces, how he can justify a stacked piece is one thing. First of all, specificity was important for Judd, because if you have two things he talked about in specific objects, if you have red and green on the surface of a canvas or a piece of paper, they become relational. Okay? They develop a relationship. What you start to have is a composition. And, okay, so what's the problem with a composition? You would think a splotch of red and a splotch of green on a surface of a canvas is nice and literal, right? It would be good for the minimalist. No. Once you start composing, you allow intuition and subjectivity to come into the work. Right? There's a decision made there. There's a relationship made. There's meaning that struck from that relationship. And so for Judd, anything that's two or relational is subjective. Okay? And subjectivity here is what he is trying, he and many of the other minimalists, but probably Judd in the most extreme way, is trying to push out of the artwork. Okay? So that is the main reason why specificity is so important for him. He shows specificity in this work by using, for example, the plexiglass. When he was younger, he would, and didn't have the money that he would later have, he would use a lot of wood that he would paint. He really wanted an art form, not necessarily that was sculptural, but he said it was somewhere in between painting and sculpture. And you can see that here, right? It's attached to the wall, it's a relief, but it's also evidently sculptural. So he was creating these objects out of painted wood. Well, painted wood is two things, right? And also, once you paint wood, it's going to have errors, right? It shows the handmade, and we know by now what the problem with the handmade is. It shows subjectivity, it shows error, it shows human whatever. And so one of the things that was nice for him about the color plexi was that the color and the material were fused. Okay, so it really became one thing in that way. Also, as I'm sort of hinting here, by the time Donald Judd is making the stack pieces, he's not making them. He hired fabricators, his famous company was the Bernstein Brothers, to make his objects. So he would give them plans, he would give them designs, and he would have them make his objects. That way they would be perfect. They would be pristine. They would not show the hand. because that was not what was important for him, and it actually was what it took away from that specificity. So he hired fabricators to make his objects. I think, except for, I don't know, two or three works that I can think of, every single Donald Judd piece is titled what?
Untitled.
Right. Once you start titling, you evoke. Okay, so the only solution for Judd was to use Untitled. Okay, so we talked about that. We have these beautiful stack pieces here, but how is this specific? How is this not relational? I'll sort of ask you. How could he justify specificity here?
But it is relational. I mean, that's where it all falls down. First of all, it is two materials. The plexiglass may be an important component, but it's only one, two, and that's obvious. And then its interaction with the room and the light, it's inevitable that you look at the patterns of the light coming through the plexiglass
right.
on the wall. So, you know, is this goal really, in this case and in many others, a fool's errand?
Right. Robert Smithson wrote a review of Donald Judd's work where he was looking at some of the plexiglass boxes, and Robert Smithson speaks much more eloquently than I can, but I mean, they're pretty. Look at that pink, you know? And like you said, it glows almost. And we're not supposed to have pretty in the specific object, right? So yes, I mean, anytime you come up with a formula as reductive as Judd's was, you're gonna find contradictions within there.
And then obviously, I mean, Adagionati, he wanted it to relate to the environment.
Right.
So it's not just a specificity. I mean, because it's just all related to the environment.
Absolutely. And of course, many of you know the Chinati Foundation in Marfa that Donald Judd founded in 1971 in Marfa, you know, out in West Texas on an old army base, where he puts hundreds of aluminum boxes in these old artillery sheds. And they have this unbelievable interaction with the landscape, with the light around. So, yes. You know, I think we can also always question Judd's theories. But how do you think Judd would have justified that this is one thing?
That everything fuses into one element.
Right.
That's what he has to say.
Right.
I mean, you can, like an atom, this is an atom. You can look at the electrons and the protons, but this is one essential function.
Right.
And that is something about
Well, right.
The first box is the same as the fourth box.
Exactly.
If you took it off the wall and put it back,
right.
It wouldn't change the work.
And it's what Judd very famously called one thing after another.
Oh.
One thing after the same thing, after the same thing, after the same thing. So basically, he just wanted to stop making one thing, but he still wanted it to be specific. It's boring to make just one box, even when you're not making it yourself, it's boring, right? But so he developed this system of stacked pieces of relationships between objects that don't form true relationships because it's the same thing repeated. The space between each element is exactly the same. Okay, so by not having that variability, he justified it as a specific object. No, Donald Judd, you know, there's a very famous critic of, you know, that was so important for abstract expressionism, Clement Greenberg. And Clement Greenberg hated minimalism. He called it furniture. But in response to Clement Greenberg, Donald Judd said, art need only be interesting. And I think he might be... I'm guessing here, but I think he might be open to the idea of what people consider to be interesting. You know, some people consider, you know, geometric, meaningless shapes to be interesting. Some people want to find something evocative about it, you know. But I think he would always return and say, That is not my intent. Okay? My intent is not to be, you know, what one thing you can't do about this piece, I think, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is you can't see Donald Judd in it, except for, of course, his reductive approach, right? You might be able to say, you know, this reminds me of something, or, you know, the plexi is really beautiful, but you can't read an individual artist touch within it.
But what about the very dimensions? What about the decisions about the dimensions of each of those rectangular solids?
Right.
Fibonacci's.
Right.
Play a role in its decision. But if it's a decision,
right.
Then it goes against the precept.
Right. I mean, he's using dumb math. I mean, not Fibonacci is basic. It's not dumb. It's basic. But yes, he's using that again, and it's not here, but he uses it to push out subjectivity again. But yes, a decision does have to be made. And so in many ways, we can say that here, even though it's a very physical presence, the whole art object is just an idea. It's just Donald Judd saying, I'm gonna do this. And so in many ways, art historians point to the link between minimalism and conceptualism. Because Donald Judd, even though this is very physical, it's not dematerialized, it's just an idea. And yes, any idea you could argue is subjective, but Donald Judd did his best, you know, not to make it so. Right. Yeah, no, that's a great point. That's a great point. And every time that I teach this or another stack piece every single semester, but every time I come into the modern to see this, I am struck by its scale. The scale especially, you walk into the room and you're just overwhelmed by it. So yes, I think that's interesting to say that all of our perceptions are first sort of filtered through this relationship. Can we go stand on the André or stand next to it?
It seems to me, from a meta perspective, this bespeaks order.
Right.
Harmony.
Right.
But now all the nice stuff that we kind of intuitively gravitate to that makes us comfortable. And so, like, just looking at it within a second or two, you know that you're dealing with an artist whose sensibilities are very different than somebody who, say, used the pejorative slaps and slobs on a canvas that are going
right.
to disturb and shock and sometimes
right.
awe you. And so, you know, whether or not somebody professes to have a particular specific intent in his work, while work, it says something about him that makes that kind of subliminal choice.
Absolutely.
As opposed to, say, the kind of choice that you'd make, say, you know, that Jackson Pollock.
Exactly,
make, say,
exactly.
You know,
it's still an artistic sensibility of some sort, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's very telling, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in a way, you know, he would probably feel appalled by this kind of characterization, but in a way, it's comfort food.
Oh, yeah, he might be appalled by comfort food. I don't know. Okay, so this is an 81 work by André. We just saw his Elements, and I'm just going to stand on it because we can, right? I found by bringing my kids here, we cannot run on it, of course, but walking on it is fine. So we saw Carl Andre's Element piece, which is more representative of, say, the mid-60s. By the late 60s, he's making these planes. And he had a big retrospective at the Guggenheim where he really started to feature the metal floor works. So this is, I mean, it's still geometric. He is still interested in matter. Okay, so he likes these heavy substances that have a lot of gravity. I mean, you can really sense gravity when something is on the floor, right? And you can sense the heaviness of the metal. He used metal for his floor pieces. So in many ways, you can see kind of the consistency of the thinking. You know, if he's true to red cedar, he's true to copper and... is it lead? Steel? Okay, thank you. He's true to copper and lead, okay? And one of the reasons, and we'll talk more about this, but one of the reasons why walking on the piece is important is because he wants us to realize that steel does feel different than copper. And it does feel different than magnesium and aluminum and some of these other metals that he's using in some of his other metal plate pieces. So that resonance of the material is very important for him. I think, in my opinion, and in others, but in my opinion, one of the main reasons that he moves to the floor works is because he comes to move away from an interest in sculpture that occupies space. He said something like his definition of sculpture... or you can always tell a sculpture because when you turn out the lights, it's what you bump into. So it's something that if you turn out the lights, you would bump into, you know, the pieces in that room, for example, the geometric pieces. But he wants to start moving away from that. He had a show right before he started making these pieces where he crowded the room with these styrofoam geometric structures. You could barely walk in there. And after that, he wanted to move away from occupying space. Now, of course, this does occupy space, so to speak, but then again, it doesn't. It's almost part of the floor. And so you could argue, and again, it has been, that he moves away from sculpture that occupies space to sculpture as place. Sculpture that comes to mark a site, okay? Because when you have something on your floor, it marks this space. And this is, you know, obviously an ideal space for it. Because one of his epiphanies about making the metal pieces happened while he was on the water. And so saw the water marking a site, but not actually taking up any space sort of above it in the world at large. And so here we have this relatively unobtrusive work that marks an actual site. And of course, many of you know that there's a sort of an important phenomenon from earlier, but it becomes very important in the 1960s and 70s about the notion of site specificity, that an artwork for many cannot exist outside of its original site. That the environment, that the installation is an absolutely essential element to the piece. Now, this piece could be installed in many places. I'm not arguing for a site specificity here, but just that notion of the artwork becoming a site, becoming a place unto itself, I think was really important for Andre. Couple other things. A lot of people talk about that Carl Andre worked on the Pennsylvania Railroad, and that being a very profound experience for him. You can see, of course, the relationship of this to railroad tracks. They suggest sort of a sense of infinity, he said, about railroad tracks, but also about roads. What he liked about them is there's sort of no beginning and no end. You kind of can step into them at any site. That's actually something that Jackson Pollock said about his work, too. But so he liked that sort of infinite quality that could be created via the pieces. Something else I think that's key about the metal works for Andre is that, and this has to do with this experiential relationship that I've been talking about. Robert Morris in particular, you know, one of the big minimalists, talked about it being a phenomenological relationship with the object, phenomenology being a form of psychology or philosophy that deals with knowledge being based solely in our experience. So we have this experiential phenomenological relationship with the object that is very unique. How many artworks do you experience by stepping on them? And this, to experience an art object like this, is very unique. You don't normally look down on things like this. And look what I'm doing when I look down on it. I'm looking past my own body. So again, that awareness of myself, that awareness of my own physical presence, touching, can't touch many artworks either, right? Even with your feet, especially with your feet, but with anything. This relationship is very unique and very significant. Related to that also, it's interesting that so many of the minimalists were so interested in these kind of ordered, very clear objects. But many of them were also interested in kind of avisuality or visual art that defied visuality. Something that I think that Andre would have liked to say about this piece, and it depends on where you stand, but if I stand here and I look at Adrian, I can't see the art. I can't see the artwork. So here I am standing on it. But I mean, I can a teeny bit in my peripheral vision. I can see the artwork when I face this way. But if you stand on an object, especially from certain viewpoints, from certain vistas, the object itself, even though I'm touching it with my feet, becomes completely invisible. And so again, a lot of the minimalists, despite the fact that they seem to be making these really clear, if anything, some of the objects we've seen so far are clear. They're easy to look at. But here, I have an object that is out of my range of visuality. And I think that is a good segue to go to Dan Flavin. So if you don't mind, we can go look at his fluorescent tube in the next room.
This is a painting that's executed as a sculpture, and that, like, the tactility of it is something that makes it, you know, kind of accessible, it's playful, it gives a certain resonance when you have to, but basically what it is like a painting in its entirety that the artist is forcing you to view from a different perspective by adopting the medium of...
Right. That's interesting.
And this gets you to, you know, kind of...
Go ahead.
Relationship with it that leads you to then think about it some more as opposed to just like passing
right. Past
something that's...
Right, walking across it and going. Yeah. And I think it's interesting that you term it playful, too.
Because
I think it was
like
for him.
The medium and like the paraphrase, McLuhan from a different context, the medium is not the message here. It's
right. Okay. Dan Flavin, like Andre, like Judd, were very key players again in this early 1966 exhibition called Primary Structures. By 1966, Dan Flavin had found his chosen medium, and of course his chosen medium was fluorescent light. He sort of dabbled in working with little lights in the early 60s, but by 1963, the date of this work, this piece is called May 25th, 1963, so he's sort of marking the date, and there's a series of works that are titled May 25th, 1963, but this is one of them. This is really his first work that consists solely of a fluorescent light tube. It's called the diagonal, actually, of May 25th, 1963, for obvious reasons. It's 45 degrees on a diagonal from the horizontal. It is composed solely of a bought fluorescent light tube. Okay, he didn't ask for it to be fabricated under any special circumstances. He used, you know, during this phase of his career, what he could buy at the store. You know, and there were a certain number of colors. You could get it in gold, you could get it in pink, you could get it in blue, you could get it in cool white, you can get it in warm white. And so that's what he used. So this is an excellent example of Flavin's sort of first foray into this format. I think that just based on the little bit that I've said, you can see some of its relationship to what we've talked about thus far in minimalism. First of all, it's literal. Okay, it's a fluorescent light tube. It's industrially made. Okay, all he did was put it at an angle. Okay, and so like Judd, it's fabricated, although, again, Flavin is not having anything made up to his own specifications. He's just buying it in the store and exhibiting it as a diagonal. Now, for this reason, the fact that he is using something that is totally, you know, bought off the shelf, common, incredibly common, many have compared Flavin's work to the work of Marcel Duchamp. The Dada artist from the earlier part of the century, who is most famous for his ready-mades, his bicycle wheel. He's probably most infamous for his upside-down urinal from 1917 that he called Fountain. Because, do you see the similarity here? All Marcel Duchamp is doing is taking something that is incredibly common. He is not making it by hand. As a matter of fact, Marcel Duchamp eschewed or denied manual skill, right? He said art is of the mind. Art is a conceptual art. And so he's taking something that he doesn't make and putting it into an art context, putting it into a gallery, into a museum, and the context is making it art. So is his declaration. This is art because I say it is. Okay, so again, that's a very conceptual idea. This is art because the artist says it is. I don't need to make anything, right? That's the job of a craftsman, okay? It's not the job of an artist. An artist's goal is to think. So do you see the relationship between Duchamp, perhaps, and Dan Flavin, in that he's taking something that you could buy in any old store and putting it into an art context and saying, this is art because I say it is. I'm just putting it at a diagonal. And notice the plug. You know, it's actually a debate about Flavin. Do we hide the plug in the cord or do we not? Well, why should we? You know, he's not trying to make this into something more than it is. Okay? It's literal. Okay? So it's geometric. So in many ways, you see this relationship to the minimalism that we've been talking about so far. But isn't there also a little bit of a difference with the Flavin? There's something different that happens when you're exhibiting light. Did any of you see, I'm sure some of you talked about it, the 2005 Flavin retrospective here. I mean, it started out with works like this, and then it moved into these huge installations, right? He also created installations you can see out in Marfa, down in Houston. You know, there's beautiful Dan Flavin installations with colored light. Well, this may be just a dumb fluorescent tube, but light is ethereal, right? It starts to affect us in different ways. It transcends you know, the tube and its surrounding parts. It glows. And the lights change it, and when you have a pink tube, it changes it. So even though Dan Flavin said things like, look, this is just a tube. I take it very matter-of-factly. That's what he said. I take this very matter-of-factly. He also referred to these, it doesn't say it here, but he referred to these as his diagonals of personal ecstasy. There's various interpretations about why. But he said, this 45-degree angle achieved one of perfect dynamic equilibrium. And he said that that was a personally ecstatic experience for him. Some art historians say that's because it's phallic, and that's what he's saying, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't really matter, I don't think. But he's, I think, opening up the door, realizing that transcendent quality, that ethereal, ephemeral quality that light has, that transcends the sort of dumb hardware of a fluorescent tube. Okay. There's two painters that are represented in these galleries. There's Agnes Martin and Bryce Marden. I would like to talk about at least one of them, and then briefly sort of end on the note of post-minimalism.
Before we leave this
one, yeah.
And this may be crazy, but I read somewhere that, you know, the horizontal is a symbol for death, and the vertical is a symbol for life, and he chose the midpoint, and for that it is full of symbolism. Is that just wrong? Is that just, I mean, would that fit into diagonal of the ecstasy, or what
he said some pretty kooky stuff about his art. I don't know if he said that. I don't know.
Or maybe the reference to ecstasy, for example, pardon me, could be a drug reference. For example, it's a very familiar phenomenon, okay, that after people smoke a couple of joints or whatever, they'll look at something that seems perfectly mundane, okay, but they start focusing on it very intently, and all of a sudden there's something cool about that fluorescent light. Well, maybe he's being playful and saying, hey, if we put this in a museum context where somebody's going to come here and
right.
look at it very carefully and focus their attention on it, they will see the coolness of the light. Now, they'll see that there's, if they concentrate hard enough, that there's something, you know, ecstatic about really, you know, kind of turning off the rest of your mind and just focusing on that object.
Maybe.
Without any kind of symbolic reference.
It could be. I honestly don't know. All I really know about the importance of the diagonal for Dan Flavin is that He did a lot of diagonals, and he did a lot of corner pieces where he would put the fluorescent tube in the corner. And this is very different from what you just brought up. But like Carl Andre, Dan Flavin was very interested in the Russian constructivists. And if you know Vladimir Tatlin, Kazimir Malevich did a lot of corner pieces, because they wanted their art to really activate the room, change the shape of the room itself by putting something into the corner. So for him, the diagonal and the corner pieces are sort of evocative of the Russian constructivist era. But in terms of horizontal, vertical, I don't know. Yeah?
Did he specify whether the tube was to be connected to the floor? I mean, whether it was to touch the floor, or whether it was okay if it was away from the floor?
I don't know. I don't know.
I had a question when I gave it to her, and I didn't know the answer either.
I don't know. I know that there have been plenty of shows where they hide the sort of equipment. Okay, they don't show the outlet. They don't show the cord. But in this piece was part of a very important show, or it's a similar piece was in a 1964 solo exhibition of his, of which no piece is sold. But he was very adamant about the cords being shown.
The cords.
Yeah, but I don't know about the height.
What would you say? say about the tendency of movements and even specific artists. He'd be one, Stella would be another, that go from simplicity to through kind of a Baroque and even maybe a Rococo stage. Either that's maturation or it's a disintegration, but they go through it.
Right.
And if that's the case, why did Judd continue to champion Flavin if he's talking about the ecstasy of a diagonal piece of life?
Well, you can easily ignore that, you know, which I think, you know, Flavin was not a copious writer, you know, so I think, and he did write things that accompanied these pieces, but it's something Judd would probably ignore. And I mean, that's a really interesting question because, you know, there's a Solowit that's in the permanent collection here, a wall drawing, and then you can go to the Dallas, it's very reductive, you know, pencil. You can go to the Dallas Museum of Art and see Solowit's huge decorative wall pieces. We talked about Flavin. Look at this. Look how simple this is. But he ends his career with elaborate colored light installations. So what's the answer? Are they selling out? You know, what I would say is it's really hard to stay with this sort of degree zero approach. You know, as Clement Greenberg said, like, after you tack a piece of canvas to the wall, uncolored canvas, which a lot of this minimal art is kind of approaching, where do you go from there? To stop making things? And that's where Donald Judd comes along and says, art only needs to be interesting. So it can consist of almost nothing and still be interesting. But for me, it's just, I don't know how you would stay with this. You know, I just saw an interview with Bryce Martin, who did that two-panel painting on the wall there. And, you know, he started out with monochromes, and by the 80s, he was just doing these, like, two-color works. And he's like, I had a complete midlife crisis, you know, and so I started doing all this calligraphic work that was influenced by, you know, Japanese and Chinese calligraphy. You just reach a point where you probably can't do it anymore. Maybe Judd didn't, although some would argue that he had in Marfa, you know. But to me, there's just nowhere to go from here. Yeah. Right.
These artists change the vocabulary of art, but then they have long careers.
Absolutely.
Do you mean that same note because that's the note you started with, or do you like everything else involved and change over time?
Right. Right, exactly. And, you know, and what I started out with the challenge to abstract expressionism, is that important in 1985? No. You know, probably not. So, yes, absolutely. You're changing compared to your environment. Let's sort of end, we just won't move, okay? We'll just end with sort of a nod towards post-minimalism. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I can see why he chose the diagonal.
Why?
If you put it vertical or horizontal, it's totally uninteresting. And the 45 degrees is a lot cleaner than if you put it at 30 degrees. Then you'd have to say, why did you put it at 30 degrees? We explain that the 45 degrees is half of a right angle.
Right.
It's much cleaner.
Well, but he did do horizontals and verticals, too. You know,
they wouldn't be as interesting.
Right, right. And he would a lot of times use colored light in those. Right. Right, exactly. Okay, so let's just end by sort of turning around and we'll just talk very briefly about the Sarah and the Jackie Windsor here. Yeah, perfect. So obviously there were minimalist painters also, although Agnes Martin and Bryce Martin are very much more open to, again, the evocative in their work. And again, so to sort of say that they're necessarily minimalist is probably debatable, although they're obviously using a geometric vocabulary, okay? But just sort of a nod to the fact that painting was an important part of this kind of minimalist format or era also. We're standing here next to the Richard Serra and the Jackie Windsor, which are very key examples of this phenomenon called post-minimalism. And again, I'm just sort of ending on, concluding on this note. Again, post-minimalism is a nice art historical term coined by an art historian named Robert Pincus Witten, who said, after minimalism, we have to have something, so let's call it post-minimalism, right? And obviously what it is, you can see by looking at these objects, is, you know, a lot of times three-dimensional work that's using a geometric, literal, minimalist vocabulary, but changing it somewhat, okay? And again, a lot of it is kind of moving past this degree zero of minimalism, this reductive vocabulary of minimalism, and allowing meaning and variation to come back in a little bit. Richard Serra led. Okay, we have 1, 2, 3 led pieces here in his 1969 prop piece. Okay, it's an absolutely extremely minimalist vocabulary. There, if you read about minimalism, probably the key adjective that you will read is the word obdurate. Obdurate meaning hard, right? This is hard. Obdurate also comes to mean that it's not open to interpretation, right? Like having an obdurate personality would mean that you can't understand what's going on underneath, right? So this is a nice, minimal, obdurate piece. Thing about Serra, though, was that he liked to make his own lead pieces. Okay, he's not like Judd. He's not going to hire this out. He wants to make them. And there's a very famous picture of Richard Serra throwing lead, wearing a, you know, a very kind of hardcore mask. You know, this very physical relationship with your material. And these dangerous materials. Think how hot his lead is if he's throwing molten lead against a wall. Okay, so he's working with these, with matter like Carl Andreas, but having this very personal physical relationship with the making of the piece itself. Also, as many of you know about this piece and about all of his prop pieces, is that they are literally propped. They are literally propped. These pieces are not adhered to one another in any way. So we have incredibly heavy objects that are leaned against one another. And like any museum, the modern takes all precautions. Look, we really don't want to cross this line, right? And it's obviously propped in a way that hopefully it won't fall. But one of the things that's interesting for Serra is that it could. It has the potential to. And it's heavy. And so think about this phenomenal or experiential relation, phenomenological or experiential relationship that I've been talking about with Andre and with Judd, where we relate our body to the object. We do the same thing with the Serra, right? We walk around it. It's my size. I think about the scale of my body next to that. But with Judd, and the, not Judd, with Serra, and this is again sort of part of this post-minimal vocabulary, with Serra, not only do we have an experiential relationship to it, it's not a very calm one, is it? This is potentially dangerous. So it's not just, oh, okay, there's the object, there's my body, I get it. It's, whoa, there's fear involved, or potentially fear. And Serra very much liked just that dramatic pushing of that experience with the art object. You see how it's still all very minimal, in its approach and in its appearance, but he's pushing that experience into a more dramatic level. And then finally, to wrap up with the Jackie Windsor piece right here, this is called Greenpeace, from Greenpeace, a piece of green wood, essentially, pieces of green wood from 1966-67. You see that she is showing us a lot of what we've talked about so far. Geometric cube. It's on the floor. No pedestal. It's, you know, it's not necessarily my height, but it still has a scale and weight sort of comparable to human scale, the human body. But one of the things that's very interesting about this piece is that Jackie Windsor, she's making it, first of all, so that handmade is coming back into the piece, and it is filled with sort of errors and vicissitudes and history. Whereas Judd would have scorned the wear and tear of this piece, right? It's got errors on it. The paint is coming off. We can see the nail marks in it. She is embracing that, okay? So that although we have this very geometric, minimal vocabulary, human touch is coming back in. And very interesting about this piece, I'm sure a lot of you know, that the wood she took from the piece is from, was taken from the studio she was moving into in Soho. So they were doing renovations on her, the place that was going to be her new studio, and they took off these panels and she used them in the piece. So it was a 19th century building. Apparently it had been through all sorts of different uses, this 19th century building. It had been some sort of, called like a freak museum. It had been all of these different things. And the piece sort of absorbs that history. It tells a story, even though it's obdurate, right? Even though it seems like it would be relatively hard to read, it tells a story. And I think that that's very interesting. Also, you know, what do you want to do when you view this piece? You want to do that, right? It's got holes in it. So it's not obdurate. It's got what she calls windows, and so she relates it to architecture and all that sort of thing also. But so, again, we've been talking about this experiential relationship. Well, this is kind of dramatic, again. I mean, that's hard. You practically have to lay down to be able to look through, but that's what you want to do. You know, the piece is encouraging you to do that. And so it's almost as if she's kind of encouraging not just a relationship, but a performance. I have to move my body in this kind of performative way. It's not just walking around it. It's really getting in there with it to see what the piece has to offer. Also, it's not totally obdurate. It's open. One of the things that Robert Smithson said about one of Donald Judd's pieces, not that one, but another plexiglass box in this review that I mentioned a little while ago, was that the wonderful thing about a whole plexiglass box was that you could see the inside and the outside, and it had this beautiful relationship. Well, that is not good for Judd. Because once you start talking about inside and outside, we start thinking physical space, mental space, personal space, emotions. We're back into the realm of expressionism, right? And so, but think about that. Is that something that Jackie Windsor is doing by breaking that obdurate space, by creating an interior and an exterior? Is she opening it up for sort of references to, you know, experience, the human condition, whatever? It's interesting that Jackie Windsor was included in probably the first all-women's exhibition in the United States. It was a show put on by the critic Lucy Lepard in 1971. It was called 26 Contemporary Women Artists. Anyway, Jackie Windsor was one of the people in the show, and she didn't. It was before this type of. She was making this type of piece, but one of the things that Lepard said was she started relating Jackie Windsor's pieces to feminism, and saying that that interior exterior was a way of sort of bringing up not just personal experiences, but in particular women's personal experiences. And even some people would say that these centralized holes in a piece like this relate to artworks by artists like Judy Chicago, in which the central core relates to the female body. I'm getting a little risque here, I know, but relates to the female body in terms of breast forms and vaginal forms. Now, is that a push? You know, this is still pretty geometric, right? And Jackie Windsor was not one to ever sort of adopt any sort of feminist philosophy, at least as far as I know. But I'm just saying that I guess to kind of conclude that by bringing in this post-minimal vocabulary, even though you're using these obdurate shapes, by using the handmade, by bringing in history, by even just little windows within the space, you open it up to different analytic, art historical, expressionistic interpretations that the minimalists would have really wanted to push out. Yeah?
Have you seen Windsor Box at the DMA?
Yes.
Where
it's more open, right?
There was a fire papers inside the box to burn out, and there are scorch marks. And smoke around the world. So, you know, the personal history becomes even more intriguing.
Right.
Look how far you've gone from a jet box.
I know. But then again, it's not that far, but just those subtle changes, you know?
Is she from New York?
I don't know originally. She lived there.
Because the reason I ask is because growing up as a kid in New York, this looks quite like a lot of the playhouses they had in children's playgrounds back when I was a kid.
Oh, you know, that's interesting. But also, she was from Newfoundland, and her parents, for a living, built houses. So her mother actually built the house she was born in. So I think that's interesting. So this becomes sort of a type of domestic architecture, but also it's interesting to think about this as sort of a playhouse, too. A mini house. So what else? Any other questions? Any other thoughts?
Well, you really start out with minimalism being no relationship to anything other than the literal object, and they couldn't sustain it.
Right.
Because everything ends up relating.
It's really hard when humans make something to push out the human, yeah. Right?
if you're talking about naming things, going back and forth between titles and names, what do you think of a Tao impression? What is he referencing here? The Tao is, a Greek letter Tao is,
right, and I think it looks more like an I, but right. But I think he's relating it to an alphabet. I don't know, threshold architectural, you know, post and lintel. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, would Andre be, you know, shake his head if you said, look. What does it say? It's my size, I walk around in it, we inhabit the same kind of space, it's I, it's ego, it's existential, it's standing up. I mean, it's, you know, you can make something as simple as that into every bit as much existentialism as throwing paint on it.
Right.
If you want to. Would he say, no, you're way on the wrong track? Or would he be permissive enough to say, well, you know, not really completed until the person looks at it and responds. Would he say?
I mean, he stacked his pieces. He came up with the idea. It shows his motivation. It shows his intention. But for him, this would be a very big difference from Jackson Pollock splashing paint as like an automatic surrealist gesture that showed what was going on in his unconscious mind to that.
But it still is.
I. And that's interesting, right. Me, Carl Andre, I. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thank you guys.